South Dakota farmers lost markets during the last major tariff tussle. What's ahead as the new administration puts more trade partners on notice? From SDPB, today is Monday, March 10th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, an extended Monday macro conversation. We welcome Joe Santos and Everett Vandersloos. We'll ask the SDSU economists about the impact of economic uncertainty in the farm and manufacturing economies. The last time the U.S. skirmished over trade, soybean markets faded. Many have not returned. Now, Trump targets stalwart trade partners like Mexico and Canada. The tariffs are high, and so are the stakes for the South Dakota economy. We'll also check in with Farmers Business Network. That's coming up after the news. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment, and news is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. President Donald Trump has levied new tariffs on products from Mexico, Canada, and China. He's also put others on hold. The news is changing quickly, and that creates uncertainty in the markets. What does all this mean for agricultural producers here at home? Is there any way to avoid steep price increases? John Appel is country manager of the U.S. with the Farmers Business Network. He joins us via Zoom.
2025 was predicted to be a tough year to farm going into it. So cash receipts have been down for a couple of years now on low corn and soybean prices. And now with this tariff situation, that's going to squeeze profits further. The current situation with the tariffs was an initial announcement of 25% on Canadian and Mexican products coming into the US. That was delayed for a month. And now it looks like some products might be excluded from that. In addition to that, and probably the most meaningful, is that Chinese imports, where most of the crop protection chemicals originate from, it was announced that there was going to be a 10% tariff on products, and that was increased to 20%. That's created a lot of uncertainty and will impact the industry quite significantly. You know, at FBN, we do some buying intentions surveys, so we understand how farmers are going to behave. And about a third of them earlier in the year said they were going to delay purchases. And the reasons they gave for that was either low commodity prices, so expecting that situation to change, or lack of cash to buy as the two primary reasons for that. Another big reason for that was an expectation that input prices would drop, right? And so that was before some of these increased tariffs were announced. And so that's a risky strategy. I actually think for that cohort of growers, that initial uncertainty is probably going to get a bit more clear now going into the season to be able to make decisions, and because of the tariffs in some cases.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about a specific, if you're making a purchase, 10% versus 20% tariff, what exactly does that look like on an operation?
Yeah. I mean, if you're a typical farmer spending $40 an acre on your crop protection inputs, 20% increase in the cost of those would be $8 an acre. So that's a significant impact to the P&L, especially when there's not a lot to squeeze out there. When you're at $4.50 corn, just north of $10 soybeans, hard to make that math work anyway. And when you start to take, $8 an acre impact is really meaningful in that case.
What happens next? Do you have a lobbying arm? Are you like what are you hoping happens next on the national level for your business?
We're not going to participate in lobbying or anything like that, but we're going to kind of navigate it as it comes. Okay. As I said, we're prepared in some cases for this. I think in any case, difficult farming economies like the one we're in now, we're set up for that. And we're going to do the best to pass those savings along to farmers. No tariffs would be an easier situation to navigate, but I'm not sure that's going to be the reality going forward here. And so we're prepared for this reality at a minimum of this 20% China tariffs. And that's, there are some flows of agricultural products, for sure, inputs among Mexico and Canada, but to a much lesser extent. I mean, you have things like potash coming from Canada, some fertilizer products and things like that, a bit of crop protection as well. But the majority of the impact here is going to come from the Chinese tariffs, and that's not looking like it's going to go away in the short term anyway. And we're already products that weren't on the water prior to this February 5th announcement are subject to these tariffs. So importers are already feeling this, right? This is a reality for us today, and don't expect that to go away. So as we get into season, so here's what we do know, that crop protection prices are at a multi-year low in a lot of cases. We track this really heavily over a number of years. So they're already at a low starting point. It's at a valley a bit today. That's number one. Number two, we know that prices tend to increase as we get closer to season, right? So years and years of tracking this data, we can see that prices tend to creep up as you get closer to planting and use. And then you have the tariffs on top of it. So that would point you to a direction that there's really no more reason to wait on making the decision here. I know, we hear a lot about a lot from farmers that there are different reasons why, even if they know they have certainty over what they want to do and what they want to plant and buy, there might not be enough cash available. So they might need to sell grain. It's a bit uncertain. The uncertainty, I think, right now is on the crop prices. What are these tariffs going to do when, China announced kind of retaliatory tariffs on wheat, corn, cotton coming from the U.S., protein, soybeans. So these are all products coming from South Dakota that are, that's not going to help the crop price going forward. And so I understand that's going to be a challenge, is, freeing up that cash, maybe emptying the bins a little bit to free up cash. And or pay down operating lines and things like that to be able to maybe execute on these decisions a little bit.
That's John Appel with the Farmers Business Network. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. For today's Monday Macro, we're bringing you an extended conversation on tariffs and international trade policy. We're going to talk about the impact of economic uncertainty on the farm economy in the state, the residual effects of the trade war with China from the first Trump administration, and what's ahead for farmers, manufacturers, and consumers. Joe Santos is the Dyckhouse Scholar in Money, Banking, and Regulation and Professor of Economics at the Ness School of Management and Economics at South Dakota State University. Everett Vandersloos is also a Professor of Economics at SDSU. We connected with the two from SDPB's Janine Basinger Studio on the campus of South Dakota State University in Brookings. Joe Santos, help us understand, the word gets thrown out a lot. What exactly is a tariff? Let's start there.
Sure. So a tariff is a tax on imports, imported goods or services. And so you can think of this very practically as the individual, let's say stateside in the United States, who is importing a good from another country, is going to have a tax imposed on that good. And that individual is going to have to remit that tax payment to the government. That's it. But the reason this is so interesting to economists is because trade is so interesting to economists, trade in general, and then trade specifically internationally. So in effect, a tariff is a tax on the activity we would call international trade.
So if I want to do business with somebody from another country, I'm paying my tax or tariff to whom? To the U.S. government or to that government?
That great question, to the U.S. government. So Joe in the United States imports a widget from Canada, and Joe in the United States is going to submit to the U.S. Treasury that tax payment. So it is technically a revenue generating instrument for the federal government. It is not, and I'm sure we'll go here, it is not at this time any longer a significant source of revenue, but it is a mechanism or instrument for generating revenue for the federal government. So yes, Joe in the United States pays the tax to the United States.
And so likewise, Joe in the United States might be incentivized to not do trade with Canada, for example, and to find the things that he wants, find markets within the
sure.
U.S. if he wants to avoid paying that tax or tariff. That's part of his decision-making process.
That's right. So okay. As we sometimes say from 50,000 feet, I mean, a tax is going to limit whatever the activity is that you're taxing. So if you want some, you know, less of something, you can think of taxing it as one way to do that. So to your point, yeah, it's going to reduce the level and nature of the trade that exists prior to the tax. And to your point again, it will probably reroute goods and services, and you know, we're still going to eat, as it were, but we're going to figure out a way to do it differently to the extent that the tax governs us to decide to do it differently.
Is it punitive always by nature?
Well, I always think of this as a before and after. If what we were doing left to our own devices as a planet, we were optimizing, we were finding sort of the best, cheapest way to get goods and services across the planet, then presumably this disruption of a tax, this sort of wedge between economic activity, is going to be suboptimal. So as you and I have sometimes talked about, I think of trade maybe from 100,000 feet as actually a way to produce goods and services. So, you know, you can think of, we turn soybeans into, I don't know, BMWs. That is to say, we ship the soybeans away and then almost magically the cars come on the next, you know, ship. So it is a production technology. So to your point, if you're taxing that activity and you're sort of, you know, in that way burdening it and getting less of it, then you're making it harder to turn soybeans into, you know, German sports cars, for example.
All right. Dr. Everett Vandersloos, welcome. Thanks for joining us today on Monday Macro.
It's great to be here again.
I wonder
Thank you.
If we could go back a little bit to the first Trump administration as we're laying down this big picture, and then we're going to get to some specifics. But, you know, this is not the first time we've talked with President. We've heard President Trump talking about tariffs. It's not the first time that South Dakota farmers, for example, have dealt with the impact of that. But are there lessons looking back on how that first Trump administration used tariffs and used trade, you know, things that went right, things that had a negative impact that lingered? What would you remind us about that first administration?
Yes, I think as we remember, we all remember that during the first administration of the first Trump administration, it was tried very hard, especially pushing the Chinese to change also using these tariffs. And I think in hindsight, and maybe already at that time it was predicted that that would happen, that has had a mixed impact. I think if we think about South Dakota, the farmers lost markets, and these markets really haven't come back. So it tends to be the case with tariffs that once implemented, it's very hard to get rid of them. We saw the Biden administration keeping them in place, and if you look historically, that wasn't the first time that happened. And so while farmers themselves might not have felt that directly, they were bailed out, so to speak, using taxpayer money to make up for the losses of these in the short term. But in the long run, these tariffs have an impact that, you know, other countries are trying to shift their trade patterns. And so what you see is that Brazil has expanded its soybean acreage and is now, continues to over time has increased its exports to China. So there's a trust issue also, though, you know, beyond economics, there are trust issues. Some countries might say that the United States is less reliable as a trading partner, and so there's some of these issues there also.
Who won in the first Trump administration with those tariffs? Farmers were bailed out, as we say, or had some payouts from the federal government. That was a challenge. Did China suffer from them?
That's a good question. Who won? I think the Trump administration would say, yes, they were very effective in changing the Chinese. But economists have looked at this and have found unequivocally that the United States lost in that game. We lost markets, didn't make up for those losses, and it cost a lot of money. You know, China is big enough that it can do what it wants. And then, so it really changed the whole entire supply chain. Going beyond agricultural markets, we saw that the Chinese were then moving some of their manufacturing capacity abroad, let's say to countries like Vietnam and then Mexico.
Yeah.
And that's the situation that we're facing right now, and that's a leads to additional concerns that really the stated and maybe not so stated goal is for the many of these manufacturing operations to be moved to the United States. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't happened to a large degree. And so that's in part what I think what the administration is after at this time.
Yeah. So, Joe, help us understand this, shifting of trade patterns and the idea of, things coming back to the U.S. and building the infrastructure for things in the U.S. What's a time scale look like on some of those things?
Yeah, to Everett's point, if it's happening at all, it would happen over a long period of time. These are capital investments, and these are often what we refer to as irreversible, a term we use in economics. That is to say, once you make these sorts of commitments, it's really impossible to back out of them. Not all purchases are irreversible. There are returns in retail purchases and so on, but large capital investments are such that once you've made them, that's it. You've sort of got to dive in and stick with the decision. And the reason I'm bringing that up is the enemy of the decision maker is uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So if what we've experienced to this point has shifted trade patterns in such a way that the new optimal behavior, again, it's suboptimal relative to optimal before, but the new optimal behavior is to shift production to the United States and so on, that would require, sort of blue sky sailing from here on out. That is certainty where decision makers can assess probabilities on various outcomes and so on, but at least they can do that. What they're dealing with right now is uncertainty. They can't even assess a probability to a particular outcome. That's what we mean by uncertainty. And typically what you do then is nothing if what the decision is about is an irreversible capital investment that is going to have decades long lives attached to it. You just keep, as we say, you keep your powder dry. So it would take years to mature if you engaged in that investment right now. And again, uncertainty is precisely the sort of decision-making environment in which you will not make that decision to invest right now. So it's a really good question. If all were smooth sailing here on out, you can sort of think about this in a natural process based on historical experience of how long it takes to move manufacturing and so on. But that's not what we see out the windshield. And so it's all going to take longer. And again, to Everett's really good point, all of this is reactive to the imposition of the tariff. So if we just sort of play this thought experiment backwards, presumably had that not occurred, what would have prevailed would have been optimal absent the tariff. So all of this is in that sense suboptimal. You're all, in every case, you're dealing with the imposition of the tariff and fifth tariff and figuring out, okay, what works in light of it.
Okay, so here's my example. If I'm a small business owner and I get supplies from a company that's in Mexico and the tariffs are gonna impact me, I might look for an American-made product, but I'm not necessarily gonna build my own manufacturing so I can get my products 100% forever from right next door.
That's right, and actually, that's right, and that raises another point, which is to say, when you impose these sorts of tariffs, and you don't need retaliation to make this happen in this next thought experiment, what you end up doing is you get less trade. You don't get smaller trade deficits. So we sort of go into our corners, and we buy domestically, and they buy domestically. But the overall patterns of trade, say deficits, which largely provoke these sorts of trade wars, will prevail. They'll still be there. Exports will be smaller. Imports will be smaller. The difference between them, in theory, would be the same.
Okay. Everett, now, flash forward to today. Now we've got some of this big picture understanding. And what's new, what's different this time around? What are we seeing from this administration? They're saying, hey, here we go. There's more tariffs. What stands out to you as being different from last time or new to listeners today?
Well, one thing is what we already talked about. I think the uncertainty just seems to be quite large, and it's like every day there's something new in the headlines. And just not long ago, we heard that tariffs were going to be imposed on Canada and Mexico in the amount of 25%, And then they dropped them on Mexico. And while Canada's are the ones imposed on Canada would still be maintained for the time being. And it's, so there's a lot of uncertainty, I think. That's what stands out. And the other thing that I think is that I think the administration is really emphasizing these tariffs, whether they're really used as a negotiation tactic or, you know, what really is their true motivation or not, we don't really know yet. Or this, if they really want to go ahead and implement these extremely high rates. And that must be said, you know, we can talk about tariffs in the abstract. But normally, tariffs are in the range, when it comes to manufacturing product, in the range of, you know, 1, 2, 3% or so, whereas for maybe agricultural products or food products, they're higher, but somewhat higher, but not in the in this range, not 10%, not 25%. So these are very unusual, very high tariffs. So the even CBO did an analysis, the Congressional Budget Office, late last year, and they ran a scenario that said 10%, and so they couldn't even imagine that tariffs were going to be this high. So that's another one. So it's quite dramatic.
Yeah. Okay. So the argument is, when I talk to, you know, congressional delegates during, you know, I haven't spoken to them lately, but you hear them say, yeah, this is a negotiation. He's a negotiator. It's going to come with a hold on because it needs to settle down. And what I'm hearing you say is that's part of the problem, is that it's hard to determine whether this is a negotiating tactic or whether this is the intention from the administration to set a new normal of some kind. Do I understand you correctly?
Exactly. And there are people who say that this is the intent, to create the uncertainty so that people abroad all shake and try to change and will change their own policies before we really start to implement them for real. For example, you know, lately the talk has been about what has been called these reciprocal tariffs, mm-hmm. which simply means that I will adjust my tariff just according to how high yours are. And it so happens that most tariffs imposed by the United States, at least on manufacturing products, are low. And most countries that we deal with, they have low tariffs too, but they might be a little bit higher. And it could be that simply because we threaten these other countries, that these other countries will then lower their tariffs. And they might. We don't know yet. It's too early to tell, but it's a dangerous game to play because the other countries are starting to lose they're not sure what to believe, and they might say, you know, if I really want to have a supply chain that I can rely on, I might talk more with competing partners, so to speak. Sure. That's not easily done because the United States market is so large that there's a lot of potential for other countries to try to export their products to the United States. But still, it creates all that uncertainty. And that's of concern. Just like Joe was saying, that imposes a cost in and of itself because people are not going to easily spend if they don't have to. So they might do a wait and see type of thing. That might not lead immediately to a recession, but it might slow down the economy for a time.
Yeah. Okay, so help me understand it from what you have seen. Either one of you can jump in with this, but when we think about putting America first, as the administration has said, is the goal here to bring manufacturing back to America and kind of be isolationist economically and say, like, we're going to do all this stuff ourselves? Or is the goal here to say, hey, we are big, we're the United States, we can dominate this international trade market. We want to trade, but we just want better deals. Like, do we have an understanding of what the goal is? Joe?
That's a really good question.
I mean there's a political goal. I mean, we know there's political goals here, right? But that's not right. What we're talking about. We're talking about, like, what the economic goal is. Do you have a sense of that?
And, you know, I've heard two of them, and they actually conflict. So there's the threat, you know, that we're going to impose tariffs unless you do this, right? Well, implicit in that is the acknowledgement that tariffs do burden trade and cause the negative economic impacts that Everett so clearly laid out.
Right. And
then there's also sometimes the discussion about how, well, the goal is to generate revenue for the federal government, which of course, to do that in any meaningful way, well, you can't do that in a meaningful way with tariffs because of just the scale of federal government expenditures. But
You wouldn't collect enough from that. But even if you could, then you would have to have a persistent tax policy around tariffs, which sort of denies the initial argument that this is, you know, a bad thing that you're using. Precisely, it's because it's a bad thing to get what you want from a counterparty. So I'm not sure. We've heard both. And then we have heard that sort of more kind of mercantilist argument that shuns economic transactional dependency on other countries. It's really that kind of dependency. It's nothing really more than that, but and shuns that and says we should do it here, not abroad. And again, I go back to, and I'm sure Everett's thinking this too, all economists do, that if the optimal path was to engage in that sort of trade to begin with, optimal meaning we were all better off, then as tempting it might be to think about that production facility in our hometown, that production facility is not in our hometown, maybe because we all do better if we sort of outsource that, right? So it's I get the thinking. I'm not sort of belittling it. I understand that thinking of let's bring it home. But again, I think we do have to be very careful to be so broad in our argument that way, because it may be the case that it's not home precisely because something else is home, and that has been outsourced because we're better off that way.
Sure. Okay. Everett, what would you add to that when we talk about like the purpose of this, the overall economic purpose beyond just the political purposes?
Well, I've been teaching international trade for quite some time, and I always used to say that a tariff, you know, from an economic perspective, has two purposes. One would be to raise government revenue, and the other one is to protect the domestic industry. And that was it. Lately, of course, the motivations have the true motivations seem to be political, and various reasons have been given. Like one is to reduce trade deficits, and Joe went into that. Basically, that's a lousy argument that doesn't work very well. If you impose tariffs, that is not going to reduce your trade deficit, because fundamentally it's about how much we save, and as long as our savings are too low, then we're not going to be able to reduce our trade deficit because we need the financing for our productive capacity.
Okay.
And then the other one is, other reasons is to try to extract concessions from other countries, and different people call it different things. You can call it negotiation. Other people call it bullying, and try to influence global supply chains, meaning that what we just talked about already, to try to move manufacturing from China to other places. And so lots of different reasons have been given. There are also economists and on the legal side who have been saying that really what this is all about is that sort of analogous to the debate within the state, this idea of should we reduce property taxes and increase sales taxes? And so we have to talk about things like which taxes are more progressive versus others that are more regressive. Regressive means that the lower incomes bear a bigger burden of the tax. Progressive means that the higher income, people in the higher income tax brackets or higher tax brackets would pay a higher proportion of these taxes. And the argument on the international trade side would be that, okay, we are going to raise, we see what the government is trying to do. They want to raise tariffs. They're cutting the people working for the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service. And we want to reduce taxes. And so this tax reduction set of goals of the Trump administration is disproportionately affecting the higher incomes. Whereas if we talk about tariffs being a kind of a tax on import, meaning it's really like a national sales tax. And those taxes are disproportionately borne by the lower to middle income groups, whereas the tax cuts are disproportionately the ones that benefit from that are the higher income tax. So that's okay. That's another way to look at this that we don't often hear about. But it looks as though sometimes that this is all chaos and uncertainty, but it could be that there's a deliberate way of going about this. The other thing is related to this is that tariffs give a lot of power to the executive branch. Whereas ordinary tax policy is more in the hands of Congress. So there's all of that too. This gets very complicated, but there's you know, it leads to some interesting thinking about what's really going on here.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that was very insightful. I have not thought about that before. I want to go back to this uncertainty piece. Does anything good ever come out of uncertainty, and how long can we sustain the uncertainty economically, Joe?
So yeah,
I heard Everett say recession.
Yeah.
Those two questions are connecting in my mind, and I'm wondering.
Yeah, I mean, uncertainty restrains economic activity, and in particular, the sort of economic activity you mentioned that is large, complex, long-lived capital investments, right? I mean, you still buy peanut butter with uncertainty, but you may not invest in the plant that produces peanut butter with uncertainty.
Right.
We don't, aside from maybe certain financial speculative activity that sort of, if you will, trades on the uncertainty in a sort of paper trading sort of way, that aside, very few folks are going to generate, you know, real income and raise quality of life because of the presence of uncertainty. And it's, so what it has the effect of doing, it's essentially like a supply shock. It's also in many ways like a demand shock, in the sense on the supply side, the supply chain and those sorts of patterns of trade are disrupted. And on that demand side, individuals, again, may keep powder dry and not purchase or engage in economic activity in the way they otherwise might. So I'm not sure exactly what that does to prices, which is why the inflation question keeps coming up with a lot of certainty around it. But unambiguously, if this country doesn't produce it and I don't buy it, there's less of it. So those two forces work in the same direction with respect to output. So when you talk about the R word, that's a, you know, sustained broad contraction in economic activity. Supply shocks do that. Negative demand shocks do that. Uncertainty creates both of those sorts of bad shocks. So I think that's why you're hearing the R word in the presence of uncertainty.
You said a couple of things there that made my brain think of the pandemic. Is that a reptilian brain response, or are there parallels that are worthy of drawing here?
Supply shock part, yes. This has the added effect, maybe, though, of, you know, I there was no question I was buying the Peloton bike, right? If I could just get it shipped to me. Here, I can't get it shipped, and I may not buy it because maybe in my household it's essentially a large capital investment, and it's not reversible, and so I'm not going to do it in the presence of uncertainty. So to your point, you got the supply shock like you did before, but now maybe you also have a negative demand shock.
Okay. I want to talk, Everett, about the impact on different groups of people. Farmers, what's the impact of these tariffs on South Dakota ag producers? What can we say about that that's relevant, do you think?
You know, the fear on the agricultural side is the other R word, and that is retaliation. Mm-hmm. And so that if we impose tariffs, then other countries are going to, and they have already done that, they already study where would it cause the biggest pain to the United States to do something in return. And it so happens that the agricultural industry is for a long time has been a net exporter, but in recent times, actually, we have been importing more food products than we export in terms of commodities. The United States tends to export the raw commodity, the corn and the soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could potentially hit South Dakota. And we could argue that it already has hit South Dakota, and that's still a leftover from what happened earlier on when as I mentioned that we lost some markets.
Right.
So for agriculture, this is bad news. In fact, President Trump has said that Now farmers would have to sell their products domestically, or he said it in a different way, but that's what he meant. And but of course, domestically, the market isn't big enough here to absorb all the product that the United States is so blessed with being able to produce, because we have all this good soil, good climate, especially in our area, of course. That would be a major concern.
Yeah.
And on something else is that, you know, we talked about, you know, going back to that first R word, recession, is that so we talk about imposing tariffs, high tariffs on Mexico and Canada, which would, by the way, be counter to the U.S. Mexico Canada agreement, the follow organization of NAFTA. So we throw that out the window, and we want to impose these tariffs, even if we don't go to 25%. And the government has said we want to. They, earlier on, they said they want to increase tariffs in the amount of 10% on all imports. That in itself has created trouble in within our trading partners, and particularly a country like Mexico that relies so heavily on exporting their products to the United States, that can quickly cause havoc in their economy. That it's not so difficult to imagine that that might create a recession in Mexico. And then ironically, if that would happen, that would create less opportunities for people in Mexico. So that would mean probably more migrants trying to move across the our southern border. And so that's another thing. So we can talk about, you know, what's happening within our country, but this has global impacts. Yeah. And first and foremost, within North America, but beyond that too, of course.
Yeah. And then we dive back into those politics, Joe, because part of the reason that we've heard the Trump administration say these tariffs are being talked about and perhaps implemented is because they want to get some kind of behavior, some political behavior from the Canadian or the Mexican government to secure those borders. And what I'm hearing Everett say is that that might not work economically once you put the numbers into the the equation.
Yeah, I think Everett said it far better than I ever could.
Yeah, I'm just making sure I understand
No, no, it's it's a sort of the idea is it's so bad and I'm serious about this and I'm going to impose it unless you do what we want you to do. Yeah. You know, like any sort of threat like that, its credibility wanes if with repetition. If you continue to say no, this time I'm serious, I'm really going to do it. Yeah. And if you do pull back from it because of the destructive effects.
Okay.
It loses its bite. So I think we're also witnessing some of that.
Yeah.
Those sort of iterative processes playing out, and maybe that in part explains why the levies themselves are getting so astronomically high, because you sort of have to outdo your last threat.
Yeah. Okay. Impact on manufacturers. A lot of people are asking me if they're going to buy a car. Should I buy a car now? Should I not buy a car? Should I wait till next year? Should I wait 4 years? Manufacturers and consumers are both really in that moment where people are trying to make decisions on the ground level. Everett, how will this whole uncertainty and the tariffs themselves impact manufacturers and the consumers who are trying to decide whether or when to buy a big product, a car, a refrigerator, something that the Peloton bike, something that's not like peanut butter.
Well, there's an area where we
a big
where
widget
we already,
or a little widget.
Yeah, but there's an area where we've already seen an impact. I believe they have already been implemented these 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum, and so what that does, that's nice for the steel producers here in the United States because it raises the price of steel and aluminum. But it's not so nice for the car manufacturers. These higher input costs, and that's an input cost for the car manufacturer, these are going to be at least in part passed on to consumers, and there's no doubt about that. So these products would the final products would be more expensive simply because they have to pay higher input costs.
Yeah, and then either in demand or not demand, and to what Joe was saying, I might not buy, I might put off a purchase for a long period of time until it settles down, which would reduce the demand.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
If I just have an additional thought on this retaliation thing is that, you know, one of the smartest things that other countries could do is not to do anything. And that this is something that been brought up by a highly respected economist from I believe it's at Harvard, Danny Roderick, and he's long said that this great move toward globalization is going to lead to some sort of a backlash. And his argument on this one is to say, okay, if we recognize that tariffs, if we impose tariffs, means that we are shooting ourselves in the foot, then from an economic point of view, other countries should not retaliate because that it's only going to hurt themselves,
okay.
which is very sensible, of course, from an economic point of view, but politically very hard to do.
Right.
So the smartest thing would be for these other countries to not do anything and at least not to retaliate in terms of tariffs, but maybe do some basic things to so that politically it appears as though they do something. But that's probably not realistic.
Yeah. Cooler heads that's prevail, really like investing.
Point. That would be very nice, but I guess...
Not necessarily what's going to happen. Yeah. Okay. All right. Who else is impacted that you want to bring out here? I mean, I think some of them are obvious when we talk about the state budget. We're already seeing, the impact on state revenues and the ag industry and how that impacts us. Lee Strubinger has done some great reporting on this just today. Other areas that you want to bring up today that you think maybe might go overlooked?
I'll just throw in, since in homage to Monday Macro, there is the monetary policy piece of this, which one would be forgiven for not connecting the dots. But
I almost clapped my hands when you said that, which I don't know what that says about me now, Joe. You said monetary policy, and I went, wee!
That's right. And so,
let's talk about monetary policy. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Because you're raising prices. I mean, there's sort of three places where the tariff can be absorbed. And of course, it's a combination, but let's just think of them discreetly just as a thought experiment. The seller to the United States could say, well, I'll just sell it at a lower price and, essentially take the hit so that everyone else can pay the tariff, but not really pay a higher price. Well, that's one possibility. The other possibility is the importer, the firm, whoever is importing the steel says, all right, I'll take the hit, but I won't pass it along. And then the other one is, of course, the consumer who buys the product and they take the hit. So it's going to go somewhere, right? It's just arithmetic. And the outcome of all this from a macroeconomics perspective is that it could very well be, I wouldn't say it's inflationary, it's sort of one time, but it would have an effect on the price level that is to raise it. And so if you are the central bank right now, I thought of this when you said who could be affected. Well, anyone who's looking to finance anything, let's say mortgage finance and so on, who's hoping interest rates go back down sooner rather than later, they may be disappointed because now you have a tax instrument that is, tends to raise the price level, if not create inflation, the level versus the growth, but it'll raise the price level. It'll give you a couple of months of really scary readings, and that will then inform the central bank's reaction function. And the central bank will say, well, never mind cutting rates. We thought we were going to do that three times, but now it's twice or maybe once, or we're not going to do it at all, right? So it has the capacity to slow the rate of monetary easing that I think everyone was expecting. So that's another piece I think to consider. Again, I don't want to overplay this. It maybe doesn't have growth effects on the price level, but it to the extent it raises prices, even if it's once and for all, you can have a bad CPI reading 1 month or whatever, and that's going to slow the monetary easing that might otherwise be in the plan.
Mark it down. We're going to be talking about that again, I'm sure.
I think so.
Everett, I have one more question for you, and it's a little bit unrelated. So if you don't want to answer it, that's fine. But I've also been curious about, with the change of the administration, I remember, President Joe Biden talking about, when I think about renewable energy, I think jobs, 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 jobs. Obviously, President Trump has a different idea of what jobs look like and what renewable energy how that should be invested. What happens when that kind of investment and administrative leadership shifts so rapidly and projects are stopped or halted, or are they not stopped or halted? I guess I'm just curious to what happens to the things that might be interrupted when it comes to economic development for renewable energy.
Well, I think it's somewhat along the same lines, is that the rules of the game are shifting, and that uncertainty. Companies had already decided they were going to make these investments, and now all of a sudden the carpet is pulling from underneath them, and so it's being pulled away. So that has. That these similar kinds of effects.
Yeah. So a new administration that's going to come and reverse the reversal.
Yeah.
They're going to have to do some mighty fine convincing to get me to invest in something.
Exactly.
That is going to take me more than 4 years.
Yeah. Going back to the tariffs, one other thing, if I may.
Yeah, please.
One other thing is, something that has been well documented by economists who have studied these things in the past is that if you impose tariffs, then in the long run, businesses find it harder to compete with similar operations abroad because they're being protected with higher prices, but that means they're not as efficient as they could otherwise be, and so that's one of the reasons why it's hard once these tariffs are implemented to do away with them. So that's one thing. In theory, it might be okay to do this for a temporary period of time, but then it would be better, more efficient to let go of them.
All right, Joe Santos, wrap us up. Any final thoughts here about what we're looking for? My brain keeps going, and you can take this in any direction you want, but my brain keeps going back to how long do we before we see the impact of the uncertainty? We're already seeing it, of course. Does it just keep getting progressively worse and worse, or what does this look like in the days ahead and the months ahead? That's impossible to say, right?
It is.
You don't know what's going to happen
by the time
we air this.
That's right. But if the uncertainty persists, the sort of damper on economic activity will persist. Yeah. So. You are going to interrupt trade, whether international or domestic. By the way, I just mean economic commerce.
Yeah.
It's going to affect commerce negatively. Again, I really can't think of a scenario where more uncertainty leads to more commerce. It's pretty unambiguous. That is the relationship between uncertainty and economic activity. So, if this continues. You are going to see all sorts of cuts in investment in activity, and including in the labor force. I mean, hiring someone, training someone, these are long-term commitments as well. And you can imagine employers thinking, well, we maybe will go to market, as it were, but maybe let's not right now. So we don't do this logically, sensibly. We have a reputation to uphold and so on. We don't hire people and let them go 3 weeks later. So again, there's an irreversibility to that kind of human capital investment decision. And so you can imagine those would be, stunted as well. And again, all of this, back to your point, leads you to the R word. If it persists, as we say, poison is in the dose. And so you get the critical dose of uncertainty, and you will hamper economic activity substantially.
Joe Santos is the Dykhouse Scholar in Money, Banking, and Regulation and Professor of Economics at the Ness School of Management and Economics at South Dakota State University. Everett Vandersloos is also a professor of economics at SDSU. You can find our full Monday Macro conversation on our website, sdpb.org. And as always, In the Moment is a podcast. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngerman. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. Our engineer is Colton Nicholson. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm your host, Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.